This is Jim Inkster, and welcome to Talk Louisiana Friday Politics on WRKF in Baton Rouge and WWNO in New Orleans. We originate from the Investar Tower in Baton Rouge. Robin Dow is producing, and your number is 877-217-5757, 877-217-5757. Emails are directed to talk@talklouisiana.org. We're visiting with James Carville, the most famous political consultant of all time, and he's been in the game a long while, and he's been on this show, and he, like many others, anticipated a different outcome, and the polls indicated the race could go either way, and something happened, and Donald Trump is now won by a comfortable margin. Kamala Harris is closing the gap in the overall vote, and Trump may be pushed down below 50%, but it'll be close as to whether he actually gets a majority. But he did win 32 states and all seven swing states, and that was unanticipated. And he goes back to office as a flawed man, and we're all flawed to some degree, but Donald Trump has been convicted, the first convicted felon. He has more divorces than all U.S. presidents put together, and he's had a full life, shall we say, that also includes six bankruptcies. But he is extremely popular in Louisiana and across the South. And I've mentioned that in the Southeastern Conference states, the 12 of them, he won those 160-0 in the Electoral College, and he lost in the rest of the country 226-152. He won the SEC by 8 million votes, and he lost in the rest of the country by about 5 million votes. But he is the president, and we in the South made it happen. We are his base, and James Carville and I and you, most of you, we're sons and daughters of the South, and James Carville, here we are. We're in a Trump land, and it is a case in which he now has the enormous power that the president receives, but quite likely will have a House and Senate of his own party. What do you make of all that's happened in the last few days?
Well, I mean, for me, it's, you know, probably disappointing, but if you go to critical times, you can see the seeds of what happened. First thing that happened is the Biden administration, like it or not, was unpopular. And Biden was old and people didn't want him to run. He refused to get out until he had a catastrophic debate. He got out on July 21st. And people decided, understandably, that there was no process in place to do anything alternative. So we decided that we were going to give the country more of what they had said they don't like. And then, and probably in my opinion, and I think this is shared by people who know what's going on, the most disastrous answer given by any presidential candidate was on The View when she was asked, how would you be any different than Biden? And she said, well, I can't think anything I'd do different, which in a country that was, American politics, when people want change, they want change. And they were, no matter what, it's the economy, stupid. And I just think that the inability of Biden to get out, and what I've thought and continue to think, that there is enormous underappreciated talent in the Democratic Party. And we just kept them all in AAA. And, the mistakes we made were pretty colossal. People thought, well, given the court decisions and, the Democrats are winning elections, that we might be able to win this one anyway. And, given all of Trump's problems, as you point out, but that was not to be the case. But I'd have to say that she and Biden did a pretty good job of blocking people from voting for us.
Wow. Well, when we look at the overall votes, Trump will likely receive fewer votes than he did last time, albeit close, and she's got probably 12 million.
But he got more than she did.
He did.
Look, we'll be unearthing this stuff, and catalysts will come out with their numbers, and we're going to be unearthing this forever. But at the end of the day, this is a mind-numbingly simple business. And at the end of the day, the country wanted something different, and we didn't give it to them. And we could have. That's the real tragedy. She actually, to the voters, it came across like she was insisting she wasn't going to change anything. And, you know, that's the haiku of all politics, is change versus more the same. And this was a two-thirds wrong-track country. And, you know, there was this hope that Trump's unpleasantness combined with the Dobbs decision would be enough to take us over the top. It was not. And now you're an opposition party, so you better start acting like it.
Well, we're going to go to the callers, and we do ask that you be brief. James can only stay today till the bottom of the hour, so please wait.
I got to get off. Right.
I know you're busy, man. Yeah. Busy man.
I'm glad to do.
Well, we're honored. But
go ahead.
But a listener asked a good question, and before we go to the calls, this went online about the choice of her running mate. As it turned out, it probably wasn't the best choice. I don't think it was the best choice.
I don't think it mattered. Who would have been better? When people say, well, it could have been Josh Spiro, but we didn't carry Michigan or Wisconsin. There were 7 swing states. We lost all 7. And that's one thing I said consistently. They're not going to break 4-3. I was hoping it'd break in her direction. It broke against her. But I think the idea that Waltz somehow or another, he had never a very good debate against Vance, but I don't think that was determinative. I think what was really, really determinative is we had no process to, as I told Adam Negern in New York Times, we didn't get to kick the tires. They just gave us the car. So you got to buy this car. Can we look under the hood? No. And maybe she could have done better with device, but I mean, she couldn't have had a better debate. She couldn't have had a better convention. The country wanted something different, and we refused to give it to them. That's as simple an explanation as I can come up with. And I think it's also simple, and it also has the added advantage of being correct.
All right. Please be concise. James and Harvey, you're first up with James Carville. Hello, sir.
Okay. I've got 2 questions. First one, do you ever consider going back to teaching?
No, I'm 80 years old. I taught 3 years at Northern Virginia Community College. I taught 9 years at Tulane. I taught 4 at LSU. I taught junior high science when I was right out of the Marine Corps. But I love teaching, but it's a lot of work to prepare for 2.5-hour class. But I appreciate I appreciate the talk.
And before we leave, we'll get an update on his documentary, which has been received exceptionally well. But Robin says 1 question per caller. Let's go to Jim on I-12 between Baton Rouge and New Orleans. Jim, you're on. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Carville. Jim.
Thank you.
We had a test on Tuesday as the American people. We failed it miserably. Now, when we're up against both houses of Congress, potentially, a judiciary and the Department of Justice stacked with sycophants, what do we as the American people do?
All right. What about the fact that the Republicans have it all now? They've got it all.
So the question is, what should the Democrats do now? The first thing is, I'm sorry, didn't ask me the question.
Yeah, that's it. That's his question. Democrats are not playing a good hand right now. What do they do?
Okay, so you're right. But the first thing that anybody does, you assess where you are. We don't have a good hand. We have no power. So let's look to what a classic opposition party does. Because sometimes in a constitutional system, you say, we're an opposition party. We should try to negotiate and get a little bit better deal than we can. I don't think that's available to us. So an opposition party creates its own opposition. It puts out alternative plans. It organizes and it organizes a whole communication effort to tell you what the opposition is doing. My dear, and don't laugh when I tell you this, but the most underused asset in the entire, potential asset in the entire Democratic Party is the DNC. It's useless. If anybody even knows who the chairman of the Democratic National Committee is, you don't know what that person looks like. His name is Jamie Harrison. I happen to know what he looks like, but barely. You have to put that, there has to be a center. There has to be a rallying point for our opposition. Then you have the 2026 off elections. What I would do is I would have they used to do this. I would have like a mini off-year convention. And in fact, there's so much talent right now in a Democratic Party that people don't know about. We're stacked up with 350 hitters in AAA. Let's get them on the field.
We'll get James Carville back on the field in 89 seconds right after this pause on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number. If you are brief, we can get to three or four more calls with James Carville, but please be concise. And we're, of course, joined by our audience in New Orleans at WWNO, and the WRKF audience, which is with us 5 days a week, is also on hand. So let's go, Robin says, to Donna in Baton Rouge. Donna, you're on the air. Good morning. We're with James Carville.
Good morning, James. Can you speak on the transgender issue?
Was that hurtful to Harris?
Apparently it was. And I'm old and I don't get it. My favorite guy in this whole fight was Spencer Cox, the governor of Utah, when the Utah legislature passed some transgender thing about high school athletes. And he said, look, there's 100,000 high school athletes in Utah. Four are transgender. Please figure it out. And maybe I'm clueless, but, you know, we have Louisiana High School Athletic Association, the Olympics. There are all kinds of people that deal with this. I'm just talking about in terms of athletic competition. I think her being for transition surgery for prisoners was a really dumb thing. Even though these children have so many issues, and they deserve sympathy, compassion, help, support. I mean, the suicide rate is a gazillion times higher. But and apparently it's true that there were actually two cases of transition surgery done on prisoners. I'm for legalizing marijuana. I'm not for legalizing marijuana in jail. And the whole Democratic Party that got caught up in what I call identitarianism, or what most people call it, wokeism, we've lived to regret it. It is one of the great dumb movements that anybody could possibly think of. And of course, Harris, you know, she rejected it all, thank God, but she got caught up in that foolishness, and that's what it was, utter and total foolishness. And it cost us a lot. It you know, the hangover from it was still there. It was, you know, defund the police, which I call the three stupidest words in the history of the English language. People were still citing that. We couldn't wash the stench of that off, no matter how hard we tried. I don't give it time. Hopefully 4 years from now, we'll be living with it. But it was a really, really dumb thing to engage in.
Well, before Harris was the nominee, James Carville was reflecting on the dangers of what he called faculty lounge politics.
Yes.
And Brett Stevens, yesterday in the New York Times, put it this way: the Democratic Party at its best stands for fairness and freedom, but the politics of today's left, writes Mr. Stevens, is heavy on social engineering. It increasingly stands for forcible imposition of bizarre cultural norms on hundreds of millions of Americans who don't want to live, who want to live and let live, right, but don't like being told how to speak or what to think. Does he have a point?
That's not currently. Let's be fair. Harrison never used any of that language. She got enamored with it 5 years ago and paid a price for it. But she did not use that language. No Democrat uses that language anymore. But the my point is that the aftermath, that the odor was so noxious, you know, it's like you get smoke on your clothes and you're trying to wash the smell out. And when this stuff happened, I was like, literally, you know, Sean Illing, who wrote for Vox, who's actually a
sharp guy,
manship grad, very sharp guy. I did the first interview saying, this is politically, you can't imagine how stupid it is. This was in the spring of 2021. And it was, it just stuck with us, and it was sticky. And no one was espousing this, saying, you know, this anymore, but we couldn't get rid of it because it was so stupid.
All right. Let's go to David in Atlanta. David, be brief. You're on with James Carville.
Mr. Carville, the late, great wrestler commentator, Bobby the Brain, would say, win if you can, lose if you must, but always cheat. The Republicans, like Trump, advance, cheated by telling lie after lie after lie.
Is that simplistic, or is David onto something?
Well, that he says lie after lie after lie, that's not even a debatable thing. I think the Washington Post has like 30,000 of them. And the problem with him is that he lies so much, you don't know which one to focus on. And but the guy from our friend from Atlanta has a really good point. But you know, if we lied that much, our voters wouldn't stand for it. Their voters actually like to be lied to. And if you tell them it's something they want to believe and they find out it's not true, they still want to believe it.
Okay.
It's just a fact of American life and American politics.
Patrick in Baton Rouge. Hi, Patrick. You're on.
Hey,
Patrick.
Hey, you talked about you guys are playing a bad card. The race card, do you think calling, you know, Republicans racist, fascist, comparing Trump to Hitler, did that work?
Well, first of all, General Kelly compared Trump to Hitler, okay? General Milley said every bone in his body was fascist. And I know there's a lot of people that say that we should never compare, you know, we should never talk about what happened. Unfortunately, I can't erase the years 1933 to 1945 and say, well, there's nothing to learn here. I think there is something to learn. And, you know, and like most people, I think, that think about history, see a real danger in, you know, and authoritarianism has always had its appeal to people, that if we just get a strong person and put them in charge, they'll be able to fix everything. And that's just not, history has not borne that out, but that, you know, and I don't know whether you say somebody's Hitler or not, but there's no doubt that Trump has authoritarian tendencies. He espouses extreme nationalism. He espouses disdain from, you know, immigrants and other people like crazy. I mean, if you go and you look at what it means to be a fascist, you're going to start checking a lot of boxes.
Well, James, before you go, I want to note that on the 14th, as in next Thursday at the Manship Theater, your documentary will be featured. And, of course, that's one of the great venues in America, not only in Louisiana, but there will be some give and take afterward. And I think I'll have the microphone. Unfortunately, James can't make it, but James.
I'm going to try. I don't think I can, but I would love to sit and watch.
I would love to see it.
You know? All right. Thank you, man.
Well, thank you, James. Good to hear your distinctive voice, and I'm sure James Carville is revving up to fight for another day. He's an amazing force of nature in his own right. It was on this date, November 8th, 1970, that Tom Dempsey kicked a 63-yard field goal as the Saints at Old Tulane Stadium beat the Detroit Lions 19-17 in the last second of the game. Al Wester, when I was a kid in New Orleans, he used to hang out at the Walgreens at 900 Canal. He was the guy who called it. Here he is, 54 years ago today.
Will it try to kick the longest field goal in National League history? They're sending him on with 2 seconds left. Scarpetti will hold. Here's the snap. The ball is down. Dempsey kicks. It's on the way. It is. Go! It's good!
longest kick in the history of the National Football League in, at that point. And the previous record before Dempsey's kick was 56 yards, so he broke it by 7 yards. Tom Dempsey was a straight-on kicker. We don't see that anymore, and he was born with half a foot. So he was an amazing force of nature himself. And Tom Dempsey, of course, lived that moment over and over, and it's replayed kind of like Billy Cannon's run on Halloween is replayed in Baton Rouge. It was 54 years ago. The Saints didn't win a game the rest of the season, by the way. After that, they lost 6 in a row under J.D. Roberts. But it was year 4, and all was grand on this day 54 years ago at Tulane Stadium. We're back after this with more Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Rob and Dow producing, and we're joined by our listeners at WWNO. Over 50 years on the lakefront, and in Baton Rouge, WRKF, which in January will celebrate 45 years in the capital region. Both stations are thriving under the leadership of Paul Mawson, and at times RKF in Baton Rouge has been the top-rated public radio station in America. Your number is 877-217-5757. Brooke Thorington, who is the capital reporter for both stations, and Greg LaRose, who's the editor of the Louisiana Illuminator, are with us, and we'll cover some ground near and far. And we know now who the victor of the presidential election is. It's Donald Trump. He returns to office on January 20th. And unless Joe Biden resigns and makes Kamala Harris the president for a few days, Trump will be number 45 and 47 on the honor roll. And he will be the modern-day Grover Cleveland, who is number 22 and number 24. Donald Trump becomes the first presidential candidate to crack the 60% barrier in Louisiana since Ronald Reagan in 1984. And we had a red wave that went through the state. All but 7 parishes went for Donald Trump. And the 2 parishes where our show originates, in Baton Rouge and New Orleans, Orleans and East Baton Rouge, were 2 of the 7 that went for Kamala Harris. Kamala Harris got 54% of the votes in East Baton Rouge Parish, which used to be a Republican parish, and she won resoundingly in New Orleans. And we did have a change in the congressional makeup. We now have 1 more Democrat, thanks to a new majority black district, Cleo Fields receiving 51%, and Elbert Guillory ran a strong and gallant campaign to finish second with 38%. But Greg LaRose, it appears that moving forward, it's going to be hard for Democrats to win statewide in our state. It's apparent by the fact that Trump has mojo. And when we crunch the numbers, it appears that about 85% of the white people in Louisiana who voted for Trump, and over 90% of the black people who voted for Kamala Harris. What do you make of all this in our state?
Yeah, I think you touched on it, Jim, when you called it the red wave, and you look back at last year's governor's race, which Jeff Landry was able to secure without a runoff. You look at further strengthening in the legislature of the Republican supermajority, and the fact that at the state level, the Democratic Party is, I think, still very much, and this is being kind, rebuilding mode. The fact that they did not field anyone to run against Mike Johnson in the 4th District, even as a symbolic candidate, goes a long way towards it, you know, showing there. And you mentioned Elbert Guillory, and I think, you know, a lot of us just sort of looked at that as, well, this is Cleo Fields' district to lose. Ultimately, I think there was a bit of a scare that Guillory might have put into some folks, because with the backing of the state Republican Party, he was able to encourage some people to get out, especially in the early voting period. But a strong ground game from Cleo Fields prevailed on election day. That said, I think, you know, the Democrats still in Louisiana, and I would argue nationally, have essentially a chance or a need to hit the reset button and look ahead to midterms, and hopefully, in their viewpoint, make up some ground on the Republicans' control of Congress and various state legislatures around the country.
Brooke, how do you see it?
Well, it seems like the Democratic Party just kind of tried to coast through, and they paid for it. It was like they I didn't really see much get out of the vote initiatives from the Democratic Party, and there's just such dominance now with the GOP in the South. I mean, the GOP has completely embraced Southern values of church. They've courted the evangelicals perfectly, and they court football. You know, we love football in the South. We love church. We love family. We love hunting. We love fishing, and we love guns. And the GOP has completely embraced that. And I think, you know, and it's not just Louisiana, it's all the southeastern states. They have played the game and courted them, courted Southerners perfectly.
Well, it was a route for Trump, but like the route for Biden, which was an even bigger one 4 years ago, if you look at some key states in the Electoral College, there was a lane for Harris to win, even with she could have lost the overall vote and won the presidency based on what happened, because she almost won in Pennsylvania. She almost won in Georgia. She almost won in Wisconsin. And she came close in North Carolina. So if three of those states had gone the other way, she would have been the president of the United States. So it was a narrower victory than for Trump than it appeared. Just like 4 years ago, it was a narrower victory for Biden than it appeared. But Trump's the president, and it looks like the Republicans will control the House, and that means Mike Johnson almost certainly will retain his leadership as the speaker, and he will be working hand in glove with a president he's comfortable with. What does this mean for Louisiana, if anything, Greg LaRose?
I believe just high profile. You mentioned Johnson. There's also Steve Scalise, who is House Majority Leader. If he retains that role, would essentially steer the agenda. So I think what you can expect is that, you know, they'll work with the president-elect on setting policy priorities. I think it's going to be interesting to see whether or not that policy has some sort of direct beneficial link to Louisiana. Is it broader in nature? Like essentially what I think most incoming administrations look for are your easy wins, the low-hanging fruit for that first 100 days, to where you could start touting, here's the change that we're enacting, here's the difference we're making. And whether or not, you know, this is going to solely come from the Oval Office, or whether, you know, Trump and Scalise, who've been notably loyal to the president-elect, have some say-so in that, is I think the one thing I'll be watching.
Well, we're going to have a new day with Donald Trump in charge, and maybe Louisiana will benefit, because we do have a Republican delegation that is tied to Trump, as is the governor of Louisiana, who opened a special session the day after the election and is calling for sweeping tax changes. Headline in the Illuminator, Louisiana flat tax bill clears first hurdle alongside franchise tax repeal. Brooke has been at the Capitol. What's going on, Brooke Thorington?
Well, no, the first bill is actually in appropriations right now, and trying to follow that. And then this whole package is going to be kind of a, you got to pass it all so all will work. It's kind of a domino effect. And, you know, Landry breezed through with the crime session, and that's probably about to happen here as well, that it's just going to breeze through.
Well, Greg, it's a case in which it has to go to a vote of the people, and so will the people be as receptive as the legislature to the governor's plea for a big change in the tax structure?
Yeah, that's obviously super critical to all of this coming together. Now, I think folks are likely to get on board with a flat tax, but as Brooke points out, that's just one cog in the machinery of the overall plan to scale back taxes on business, ultimately do away with the income tax. Mm-hmm. But to do that, they're going to have to extend a temporary sales tax and apply it to more services, everything from things like Netflix, dating apps, on into what the administration's calling luxury services, such as car detailing, pet grooming, And I, you know, the Richard Nelson, who's the architect of this plan, the revenue secretary, seems to think people won't mind, but, you know, who's to say? And Republicans in the legislature, I'm interested to see, you know, what's traditionally been an anti-tax party, whether or not they get behind it. But I think what at least we're going to plan to do is sort of let the public know and educate the public, like, okay, here's exactly what you'd be voting on, not just necessarily a flat tax and a reduction in your income taxes, more than likely. But what does that mean when you're voting for the whole package?
Well, the Illuminator has reported tomorrow we do have a big game between LSU and Alabama at Tiger Stadium, and a live Tiger will attend the game at Death Valley. But it won't be Mike. Mike the seventh, who is he's been in his habitat for his full adult existence, is staying there. But apparently, Greg, a Bengal tiger named Omar Bradley, the general, a hero of World War II, friend of Troy Middleton, by the way, is being sent in for tomorrow's contest. This tiger's a year and a half, and it should be pandemonium when Omar comes in the stadium.
Yeah, Omar's coming, and that'll mean something to fans of The Wire. This is something that evidently Governor Landry and Surgeon General Ralph Abraham have been working on behind the scenes and have secured the transport in, I guess, appearance of Omar Bradley. Though LSU was adamant in saying that Mike the seventh would not be brought out to the stadium. So here comes the backup plan. And with a little digging, we learned a little bit more about Omar's owner, who's apparently kind of been the target of several USDA citations with regards to the transport and housing of the big cats and other animals at his property in Florida. He leases, he's in the business of leasing tigers to circuses. So it seems that this is just a marketplace that the governor and Surgeon General tapped into.
And we're only a few seconds from going to the break and finishing up with Greg and Brooke, but Brooke's an Auburn grad, so she's accustomed to tigers.
Well, I just want to go on the record here that every game I've attended at Death Valley, the team I've cheered for has won. And I was at, you know, I've been at the Bama LSU game, too. So you probably want me in that stadium again.
And tomorrow's a big one. We'll be back with more after this. This is Jim Inkster, and thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. I did have some folks ask about the math of the Electoral College. And yes, if Kamala Harris had won in Pennsylvania, which she lost by 2 points, Georgia, which she lost by two, and Wisconsin, which she lost by 1 point, she would have gotten an additional 45 electoral votes, and she had 226, so that puts her to 271. She would have been the president of the United States. Tomorrow's a football day in the country and in our state. Tulane is riding a six-game winning streak, and the Greenies are at home against Temple. And LSU plays Alabama in the marquee game for the Tigers every year, and new coach for the Crimson Tide, and they've lost twice. LSU's lost twice. It amounts to an elimination game. But much attention will now be on Omar Bradley, the Tiger, coming in to represent the Fighting Tigers. And a few years ago, as in 2017, we visited with Paul Marks, the late great attorney, who was a caretaker for Mike III when he was a student at LSU in the 60s. And he remembered those times, and the times included a few times when he had to bring Mike to his family home on Raymond Avenue in Baton Rouge. Here is Paul Marks.
Mike had the same night house, as they call it, where he was fed, and his outside quarters were much smaller.
When you say much smaller, we're talking significantly smaller.
Correct. And it was equivalent to what I was accustomed to seeing at a zoo, and just didn't know any better. I think that was the original quarters from when Mike first was brought to LSU by Mike Chambers and others.
Well, when Mike III, as Tigers sometimes do, got cranky and didn't want to go to a ball game, it was your responsibility to get his backside across the street and go to the games. What did you do?
Well, we were instructed by his vets at that time, who did not have as much hands-on work with him as I've seen now from his very capable vets and vet students and so on. But we were instructed to feed him 6 days per week, and we simply did not feed him on the Friday before a home game. And he would usually go into the cage, on the travel cage, which was a converted Miley two-horse trailer. But on one significant occasion, he simply would not go in. And
You were waving food at him? Was that
we had a little food in the cage, in the travel cage, which was our usual method. But he was spooked and wouldn't go in, and a large crowd gathered. And I went across the street. At that time, the athletic department had very humble quarters in the the east corner, I guess, on the north end, but just in the corner there. That's where the athletic director was located, the ticket office,
Jim Corbett was the athletic director.
Correct.
You had to go get Corbett, and what did he say?
Right.
Get that tiger to the game.
You're exactly right. And he not only said that, but he came across the street with me. He got campus security to back the crowd up. He, I'll never forget, he had a gold jacket, looked like some silk or something of that nature. He took it off and waved it at the tiger.
Like a matador, right?
Like a matador, that's right, Jim. And lo and behold, the tiger went in. He didn't say anything further to me. Was cordial thereafter. I never had to go to see him again about that, but I think he was in front of the cage for less than 5 minutes, certainly, and Mike went in the travel cage for him.
Now, when he would get to the game, were you with him the whole time?
Well, he was only at the game for a short time. We would enter the stadium on the east side and go through the area that included the visitors' locker room, and were stationed there while the visitors came out for practice and went back in and came out for the game and so on. I'm sorry, we were gone by the time they came out for the game, but the cheerleaders would come over and get on top of the cage. They also did a great job of tapping on the cage, perhaps banging on it, to be candid. And that was done when the visitors were coming out for practice and for warm-up, and he would roar. And I can remember that occurring when some Crimson Tide players were there, and they jumped back significantly. We parked him in that fashion.
I would imagine so. And when you say roar, he was also moving around a little bit.
Correct.
Like he wanted to get out of that cage and come after those Crimson Tide players.
He paced around the travel cage, indeed.
Paul Marks is our guest. Many in this community of Baton Rouge know him as a prominent lawyer, but 1963 to 65, he was a caretaker for Mike III, LSU's Fighting Tiger mascot for 19 seasons, including the national championship season of 1958. He started with a bang. How did you get the gig? How did you become the caretaker?
Well, it had to be a student that lived in Baton Rouge or was committed to staying here for 2 years. I was able to get my predecessor to take care of him for a week or two during the first summer, and my successor to do the same thereafter. But it was a close friend. It's a long story that's irrelevant, but it dates back to a gentleman who we were close to being on the Board of Supervisors, and just went down through the years.
You did this for three seasons?
No, two. Just two.
Two?
Correct. I had a very attractive parking pass in order to park in front of the Animal Science Building. Of course, there was no vet school then to to get his food, which was frozen. And, of course, we thawed it out, put vitamins on top. And some friends joked with me that the job didn't take very long because the time that I spent doing it was no more than what it would have taken to have parked down by the stadium and walked up the hill to where I was a student before law school.
Were you paid to do it?
Yeah, I got, as I recall, $40 a month. And that was for feeding him 6 days a week and for cleaning the cage. Reveille had a story about that. I think they focused on cleaning the cage, which really wasn't difficult. I did not go into the cage while Mike was there. believe me, I stood my distance.
Yeah, he was a ferocious animal. And on occasion, some people have actually let Mike the Tiger out. Some Tulane students did it in 1981, and he was roaming down Nicholson Drive, and fortunately nobody got hurt. But it took 13 men to lift him onto a back of a truck and get him back to his habitat. He was a big tiger, and all of them are big animals. You wouldn't want to tangle with Mike the Tiger.
No doubt about that. I was told that he was let out somehow or another once before my job came along, and I was told that one caretaker who was dismissed after this got the travel cage and opened it up with no mic inside and
oh my.
Drove through some student areas and asked them if
they'd seen Mike.
Correct. The students were not amused.
Well, you were living just off campus, Raymond Drive, if I remember the story correctly. That isn't that right?
Well, that's where my parents lived at that time, and
if I also remember correctly, it's been a while since we talked about this. There was a night when Paul Marks had to take Mike the Tiger under the cloak of darkness and drive him to Raymond Drive, where he spent the night at your parents' house. Now we're gonna hear more about this when we return. But am I on the right track? Do I have the story right?
Your memory, as usual, is very
okay,
good.
Okay. All right. Well, this is a great story. What the heck's going on in our neighborhood tonight?
To the best of my knowledge.
That was Paul Marks. Unfortunately, we can't hear him say the Raymond Drive story, but I remember it vividly that because of the problems of feeding Mike and coaxing him into his cage to go to the games with food, and that began to wear old for Mike the Third, they decided that they would just feed him the night before, and he wasn't intimidated by any crowds, so Paul just drove the cage to his house and then got a police escort. Raymond Drive's about a mile or so from Tiger Stadium, and came back the next night, and LSU had its live Tiger on the field. And apparently that will be the case tomorrow night. It won't be Mike. It'll be Omar Bradley, the great World War II general who was a close associate of Troy Middleton, who had his name stripped off the LSU library a few years ago. And that's a story for another day, and we'll be talking about that because, as we know, LSU still has slave owners and segregationists and Confederates on buildings, but they took Troy Middleton off, a hero of two wars, and some believe that they picked the wrong guy to start with. But we're thankful you joined us. Today's the 72nd birthday of the first black basketball player at LSU, Collis Benton Temple. Happy birthday, Collis, the pride of Kentwood. Back next week. Until then, for Robin Dow, I'm Jim Inkster. Stay safe and stay tuned.